Well, we should make a start with part two of our evening. Do come and grab a seat. Well, brothers, I don't think any of you need any introducing to the congregation, but just in case we've got anyone here who's not entirely sure who you are, perhaps you could just begin with a one sentence or even slightly more summary, if you wish, of who you are. We'll start on my right.
I'm David Cook, we live in Fullerton Road, and I'm the headmaster at Merchant Taylors in Crosby in North Liverpool.
Which is what kind of school?
It's in Crosby.
David Charlton, head teacher at Weaver High School, about probably 2 miles away.
Okay. You know who I am.
Mike Holland, head teacher at Harford High School. Church is about halfway between my house and school.
And actually, it's great because we're modelling Christian brotherly love here. We have independent school, state school. We have the head teacher of Hartford High and Weaverham, which I'm not sitting between in order to keep them apart or anything like that. But we're going to model a Christian charity this evening as we talk about these things. So, Alex, my lovely assistant, is furnished with a microphone. Let's have our first question, if we may. And if you just put your hand up and wait till he comes to you. I think of it like being at school. You have to wait, put your hand up, and then Alex will come to you with the microphone so that we can all hear the question. Is that a hand? Do I see a hand? No? This could be terribly short and we'll go home very soon. Oh yes, well done. Rob down here.
We'll go with an easy one to start with. How do you work around the teaching of sort of non-Christian beliefs such as evolution and things that are, you know, accepted and pushed go by evolution as a standard? Yeah.
Okay, classic opener. I don't mind who starts. David, you were nodding vigorously. Do you want to take that one to start with?
How do you go about evolution? How do you work with evolution and adopt the idea of it?
Well, one thing's I delegated to my head of RS. And one of the challenges in secondary school is we want to get our boys and the staff to think. The way we use assemblies, we do assemblies 3 times a week, is my worry is the complacency or the lack of thought that many of our young people are doing. So actually the challenge to get the boys, ours, we've got 800 boys, to actually confront some big issues, some big life issues, so that they are confronted with alternatives, if you like, evolution versus creationism. We will have a 10-minute assembly based on that. And ordinarily I would try and get two views. We've got some very strong atheists on the staff, and we've got some strong Christians on the staff. And the way I don't know if this is the right way to do it, but we would portray both views and say to the boys, look, there are some strong opinions on both sides of this. You've got to confront with this debate. Now, you could argue I should be telling them the answer, but I don't believe that's the case for a Christian assembly. There are different forums. Maybe the Christian Union is a place where we would discuss evolution differently, but in assembly we'd present both sides.
Michael, what if you want to comment on this? Because it's been an issue recently, hasn't it, in our consultation?
Yeah, I think you may have picked on a very difficult one for Christians to argue when we talk about creationism. Certainly within our science departments, all of our scientists, without exception, because I've spoken to them as department, that they would believe in the theory of evolution as a fact. But all of them, as good teachers, even in science lessons, would bring in a discussion of creationism and get ideas from the children in the way that David was talking about, get them thinking about it. The other way of approaching it is through assemblies, but also through RS lessons. And obviously, in RS, although it is fairly secular, and it is religious education, or as we call it, studies, it is very secular in the way it's put, but teaching children of the opposing views and then getting them to perhaps come to their own conclusions. We are limited in that we can't come across in state schools as being too subjective in pushing Christian ideals. There are ways around that, and that some of them are subtle, some of them aren't subtle. But, you know, it is something that we don't need to shy away from because it's a very interesting topic.
Did you want to say anything, David, on that?
Yeah, I would do, because I used to be a head of science, so actually I had to probably do more of this than anyone else out here by the sound of it. But probably we're the wrong people to ask, because the real people to ask would be those who are teaching science day in, day out, and that isn't something we'll be doing. I think the issue is about opening up to what extent, and getting children to question, to what extent evolution is fact and where the theory of it comes from, what and what evidence is it based, and what may be different interpretations of that, and getting them to think through and draw through that. I think in reality most science departments in the country, in whatever sort of school you're in, will be dominated by people who are sympathetic to the theory of evolution. But I think in reality you'll also find a number of Christians in school who will have different views, and I think it's opening those lessons up and opening up, if you sense, a sense of debate, but also a sense of questioning of why has it been accepted and on what basis has it been accepted as a sort of a standard scientific viewpoint, and where's that come from. And I think that's all we can do as Christians, is try to bring that to the surface and open it out to people.
Thank you, Rob, for getting us off to a good start on those. Let's go to our next question. Yep. There we go. Oh no, it's from a teacher.
Hello. Yeah, thanks. Just following on from that, really. As head of RE in school, RE teacher for 30 years, I think I've heard tonight that I've been responsible for inoculating many thousands of children against Christianity. But I would ask you, as head teachers, how would you advise me and other Christian religious education teachers to approach RE in your secular state schools or independent schools?
I think, Helen, there's an assumption there, isn't there, that schools are secular, and I'm not sure I'd go along with that. I know that's the line Mike took in the sermon, but I think that's a big jump.
You're allowed to disagree with me.
And I don't think that that's entirely true. I think religious studies is very much about the exploration of beliefs and what different people believe, and having teachers who can help children to sort of think through where their beliefs come from and then challenge those in a gentle way and open them up is very crucial. And I think the value of a Christian RE teacher is that you have a sense of spirituality that you can bring into that discussion and encourage children to look at how religious views are formed and how we take those on board ourselves and how they begin to shape our lives. We can't be indoctrinaire about it, and that's perhaps, you know, where it may be different from the 18th century in that approach. But I certainly think that we can bring that spirituality element in and get people to understand how that spiritual and religious outlook impacts on their lives. And as Christians, we're in a good place to demonstrate and explain that.
Mike, why don't you go next? Do it the other order.
Well, one thing we've found in the past few months regarding our parents is they don't know how much religious input there is to their children's lives in school. They don't know, for example, that someone from St John's will come and do an assembly every half term. They probably don't know very much about the RE syllabus. And this has come out in our consultation. They didn't know that they had the right to, some of them didn't know they had the right to withdraw their children from religious-based assemblies. We were asked the question at one of our parents' evenings, would they be allowed to withdraw their children? And when told that they could already, that they were surprised, some of them were surprised by this fact. So in terms of, we've got an excellent head of RE who's not a Christian, and I think in a secular school he might almost be perfect, because he's certainly sympathetic towards Christianity. And I think, as a bottom line, you would need your head of RE to be that, and perhaps expect your head of RE to be like that. But it comes down to the subtleties that you employ in putting across perhaps the gospel, but certainly ideas of faith. And I think you can be sympathetic to Christianity while still exploring other religions. And I certainly, again, I will disagree with you, Mike. I don't think our young people are inoculated. I think through things like Christian Union, through things like assemblies, through people like yourself coming into school, people can see that we are at least sympathetic towards Christian values, and I think that's very important for them.
Okay, David, do you want to disagree with me as well?
Yeah, I think I do.
great.
I think Mike's too pessimistic, actually, initially. I think schools are places of hope, really. And I think particularly young people are open to ideas, and they're after the truth, actually. They're searching for the truth. I want to say to Christian RE teachers, go for it. Really. I have to pinch the RE too. My head of RE came from this church.
We know.
You know what Roger will teach. But although we talk about a secular society, we live in a Christian or post-Christian culture. The national curriculum says that our assemblies can be predominantly Christian. So I am very, very open about that, with all the staff, atheists included, that we will follow the national curriculum in that sense. But I'm not interested in 6 weeks of Sikhism, 6 weeks of Buddhism, 6 weeks of Islam, and then a moral-free vacuum. I think that leaves people with a lot of information and no real ability to deal with them. So Helen, what I say to the RE staff is, you know, speak with conviction, present both sides if necessary. But we live in a Christian or post-Christian world, and I want to be optimistic about that.
Can I just say, it's sometimes easy to listen to the vocal minority who are very secular and don't want their children indoctrinated, and actually they're a very small minority. And you know, I said to our RE departments, if there are issues over this, then let me have the argument with parents. If you feel that's a way to teach this part of the syllabus, if you think you may be pushing to the extremes, not the extremes but the borders of what you might think is objective, then let me have the argument with parents, because I'm happy to do that. And I think they know that they've got a Christian head teacher, and they feel confidence in that actually what they're doing isn't wrong, and perhaps we expect it. And I'm not sure many state schools do have that. If they don't have Christian leadership, their staff may not feel that support within the RE department. Certainly, you know, one of my first jobs on becoming head, one of the first things I did on becoming head at Hartford, having been deputy for 5 years, was to ring the church and arrange for our next carol service to be in church, apart from it, so we could move away from this carol. It wasn't even a carol service, it was a celebration of winter, really, Mike, wasn't it? And you were invited along.
Mm.
And
I didn't particularly celebrate winter, but that's what was going on around us.
Yes. It's that kind of ethos that you can develop. Other people may feel that they're perhaps overstepping the mark in doing that. I think as Christians, it's easier to do that.
Mike, if I could just add something. We've got about 45 Asian families in our school. Liverpool's probably a bit more multicultural, I guess, than Hartford. I don't know. About 45 Asian families, predominantly Muslim. About 30 Chinese families, some Buddhists. I don't fall out with those parents when we teach Christian values. Interestingly, they're interested in a faith education. They may not accept everything that we teach, but again, I think my reluctance to evangelise my neighbour is, in a way, if we're not careful, we place that in education, and we become so worried about what other people will think that we fear. So we don't fall out with our Muslim and our Asian families. So.
Helen, brothers, I am rebuked in my pessimism. That's very encouraging indeed. I do have to say, this book that one of the books I read, Indoctrination, Education and God, I don't know if any of you have read that. That was the one that particularly he pushes the secularisation thesis very strongly in terms of its impact. But I think, to be honest, I mean, the inoculation thing, I'm sorry that sort of came home a little bit, but in some ways it more applies, doesn't it, to old-fashioned Sunday school. Because actually the generation that stopped coming to church after they'd been to Sunday school were from the sort of 1930s, 40s, 50s generation. It was my dad's generation that were booted out to Sunday school, and it put them off for life. And it wasn't school, that was church doing that. So, did you want to come back, Helen, on any of those? Okay, let's go to another question.
The study of like science and biology especially is compulsory from sort of day one of school, but in a lot of schools religious education is quite optional up to about sort of year 9, year 8 sort of thing. So to what extent would you think that religious education should be at comparable levels to the study of science?
I'm afraid that's not quite right. Actually, religious education is more compulsory than science. It was enshrined in the 1944 Education Act and has not been taken out. So if you're a state school, you have to be taught religious education all the way through, and that was specified through the standing agreement on religious education in each area, what the content of that must be, and the time that must be spent on it.
Okay. David, Mike?
I think so.
Keep hold of that.
I think what you're perhaps getting at is certainly there are a lot of secondary schools out there who don't have what you might call proper RE departments, and they deliver RE through humanities or through bits and bobs of their English department. And in terms of teaching RS as a discrete subject, I think it's essential to have, where possible, subject specialists.
Matt, I think I know the direction where that question is going, and although I agree that it is technically compulsory, I wonder whether it is taught actually in all schools. My school was founded in 1620, and they only taught three subjects in 1620, and that was divinity, Greek and Latin. So it was pretty clear the direction where it was going. Now, that was the national curriculum in 1620, and it's quite interesting the debate about the EBAC today, about what they now decided is essential for education, English, maths and science and humanity. So I think the direction of that is, there is a concern there that we've decided that certain subjects are more important than others. My other question is, what is education for? And what are we trying to prepare young people for? And it must be about those value systems and questions of belief and big questions. But you're right, I think the drift is probably negative.
It beggars belief that you have to do history or geography as your humanities subject as part of the EBAC, but they won't accept a full course in RE. They could do themselves a lot of good by doing that. I might have expected that from a Labour Party. I'm a little surprised that hasn't been the case with the Conservative Party.
I heard your button being pushed, you know, when the English baccalaureate was mentioned there, Mike. Right to your MP. It's in the notice sheet this week, I think, if it didn't survive the cutting floor. Did it get cut? Oh, okay. All right. Well, it did. Oh, sorry. It was too much in the notice sheet. Well, we'll try and get it in for next week. But, right, it's not done yet, is it? There's still opportunity to...
I saw my MP, our MP about it, and he wrote to Mr. Gove, and Mr. Gove's secretary wrote to me and said, sorry, we'll be just history and geography.
Mm.
I think the fascinating thing, as David said, is, you know, education is a lot about values and the sort of people that we want to produce. And all the big changes in education have often come about after a period of conflict. And the enshrining of religious education in the 44 Education Act came directly at the end of the Second World War, with the question of what sort of society do we not want to be. And it was seen as a factor for good. And I think that's why none of us would believe that education is value-free, because it's about shaping young people into the sort of citizens that they want them to be, that we want them to be tomorrow. And that's why religious studies has its role in there. Interestingly, you know, we haven't talked this evening very much about the pressure on exam results, because that is undoubtedly probably the biggest driver in education at the moment in an actual school. And it's that conflict between that goal and the goals of educating towards wisdom that something like RE will get caught in the crossfire.
I read a little bit about this. It was quite consciously to be not allowing the sort of society that had developed in Nazi Germany, wasn't it? Which had been very definitely secular to the National Socialism. So, yeah, it's striking. Good. Another question, I think.
Who should determine what is taught? Should it be business? Should it be the state? Families? Who?
He's going to kick off. David? Go on.
There's quite a well-known leading educationist called Sir Ken Robinson. He thinks we are imposing a 19th century curriculum in the 21st century. In other words, the subjects which were useful in the 19th century we're still imposing. Ken Robinson says we should be teaching two things, really. There should be something about economic well-being. This is his secular version, economic well-being. He then informs the government, or he's listened to by ministers of all varieties. So he talks about economic well-being, and he talks about cultural awareness, which to me just, again, comes back to this value-free or secular or quite relative values. Unfortunately, that's the sort of educationist who is
advising all ministers. Ken Robinson was highly regarded by Labour, and I know he is highly regarded by the Coalition. He thinks those are the two most important criteria, and people like him are very, very influential.
David?
I'm a great fan of Ken Robinson. Don't mind. Watch him on TED Talks. Go to TED Talks on the internet, Google it. Watch Ken Robinson talk about creativity. And I think those are sort of value things. I think the question about who decides what's taught in schools, it used to be head teachers. And clearly we're not in that situation anymore. And it has to be a community response, however you define that community, whether that's government or whether it's more locally. It has to be what the community thinks is important. But I think it's essential that Christians are engaged in that debate. Because the national curriculum that came in 88, and there was no national curriculum in England prior to then, was directly influenced by the bishops in the House of Lords. Now, Christians need to take that role. The national curriculum is up for review again. And, you know, those questions are out there. It ultimately won't be purely my decision. There'll be a governing body behind me that'll have to have a view, but it's a much wider community discussion than it has to be.
I think what we teach needs to be broad and balanced, but it's more important how we teach it. And Mr. Gove, I'm sure you've heard his sound bites in the past year, he's very much into his facts. We had a quiz at Hartford, PTA quiz, about 6 months ago, and my wife and I wrote the questions and did the quiz. And one of my questions, I did this purposely, was I asked the question, who were the three kings of 1066? Because everyone has studied 1066 at school. And I reckon there were about, well, there were 17 teams there. I don't think there was any team there where there weren't at least 2 degrees within that team. And only 3 teams got that question right. If I asked them, if I'd put up a source, historical source, and ask them to interpret it, they would all have been able to do that because of the skills they'd acquired at school through their reading, through their history, and so on. So I think in terms of preparing people for the world outside of school, we need to be teaching skills. Facts are important. I'm a history teacher. I love learning facts. And I think sometimes we have to understand that subjects are simply interesting and therefore we should study them and teach them. But actually within that, we are teaching skills to our young people. That's much more important than the facts.
There were 3 kings in 1066?
Yes. That's right, Mike.
I only studied
history. You
studied history, Mike. I did history from 1788.
Of course.
January the 26th is when history began in my school. First late arriving. Anyway, next question. Oh, yes, actually, no, let's come to Teresa first, because then you did have your hand up before, and then we'll come to Annabelle.
I know that you're teachers at high school, so this may be a difficult question to answer, but in terms of when teachers are training to become primary school teachers, I'm presuming that they're trained in how to teach maths and English and science, but how much emphasis is actually given to learning how to teach religious studies?
Do I start, Mike? We'll start this end this time.
I don't know.
This could be a short series of answers.
David has an idea.
We've got a junior school attached, but although I can't give you detail about teacher training, interestingly, when you go to junior schools, you'll often find subject specialists in maths, English and sciences, and numeracy, literacy and sciences. You won't often hear junior schools talking about the specialists employed in RE or RI. But they need a broad skill base, usually in year 3 and year 4. And you tend to get more specialism in year 5 and 6, but I don't see any reason why a parent can't ask a junior school or a primary school head, you know, how good is your RE teaching or divinity teaching in your junior school? I think they'd be fairly surprised for parents to ask that question, actually.
We all know that children get at least a month of RS every December because every school stops at primary level, so they can prepare for the nativity play, can't they?
Yes. Oh, not all nativity plays are show the nativity kids there, do they? did you want to say anything?
No.
Okay.
No idea, really, I'm afraid. Yeah.
Sorry, well, we have one useful answer anyway out of the three. Annabelle, let's come to your question.
I fear this might sound slightly garbled, but I just want to pick up, if I can, on something that David said about the way that exam results seem to drive a lot of what happens within education, and something that Mike said about the importance of teaching skills, and then, Mike, what you did in your cartoon of the Oxbridge aspirant and the one with the average grades, and you labelled the one who's going to Oxbridge well-educated, and the other one was wise because he loved the Lord. But out of that, I just wonder how much, as parents, we actually put pressure on our children to be high achievers rather than valuing them for achieving as well as they can. So that we tend, or at least I fear that sometimes we tend to put more value on those who get the best grades. And it's not really a question, it's more of a comment around what's been said.
David, do you want to start?
Yeah, I think, Annabelle, you're absolutely right. I think there's a danger that we live in a world, especially in this area, where unless you've got strong GCSE, A-level results, you seem somewhat of a failure. And that may be purely that you've got four GCSEs at grade C and not five. And almost, you know, let's be blunt, in this area, it may be seen that you're able to go to John Deans, which is selective its intake, rather than unable to go and have to go to another college post-16. And that the danger, I think, in that environment, and it's driven by this exam culture, is that it lowers children's self-esteem. It takes away the hope that David talked about, which I think is absolutely crucial to young people, and begins this process of disengagement with society and social exclusion. And I think, you know, you're absolutely right what you say about our own children, our own families, and I think as Christians we can get seduced by the secularism of exam results and our own children's success and in business world and professional. I think there's as much pressure on us to have that as there are in other ways. But I think there's an even bigger issue out there, is those who aren't from Christian families where there isn't that love and support, what else sustains them if school says your exam results aren't good enough? And where does that culture leave us at the end of the day?
Hi, Jonathan.
Yeah, I've spent the afternoon, or part of the afternoon, with a reluctant 11-year-old doing some SATs literacy papers for his exams in 2 months' time. So I perhaps feel your comment a bit more keenly at the moment. I think it comes to an understanding as an educationalist that certain grades will open certain doors and therefore make you more independent when you get older. I'm going to disagree with you again, Mike. I think wisdom, a lot of wisdom is to do with the ability to make judgments, and part and parcel of what we do at school is hopefully give our young people the ability, skills and knowledge to make the right judgments. I'm sure I'm not the only one here who makes mistakes on a day-to-day level in my life, in my work. I'd like to think I don't make the big mistakes that I used to do 25 years ago, but wisdom, I think if you just look at it in a secular way, it's the ability to problem solve, it's the ability to think for yourself, and perhaps not get into situations that you may have done without, or if you hadn't had that knowledge.
I don't think you just disagreed with me, did you?
Yeah.
Did you?
Sorry.
I can't see it, but anyway. David, you've not said anything. Too many Davids, but you know, we'll go.
Well, the challenge, forget being in school, parents compete for their kids. We've all got to be rebuked in that area. And I think we look for genius from about age one, don't we? You know, little Johnny started walking 3 weeks before Alice, and we go on from there. My son's in the lower sixth at the moment. As a Christian parent, I want to ask forgiveness from the Lord when I pray more for his exam results than for his faith. So that's my priority, that's where we are. But I still want him to do well in school. But I want to make sure that his heart is as developed as his brain in that sense. In Liverpool, where we are, near Bootle, having go back to the results thing, though, we can have an anti-intellectualism. In Bootle, there is a paucity. There is a complete poverty of aspiration. In other words, they're such poor areas that they've got no expectations of success at all. And I want to shake the parents and I want to shake the boys and say, you can escape this effectively pretty miserable area, but you need to do well and you need to succeed and you need to pass exams. So it's a difficult balance. But I also think in our schools, although we're judged, ironically, on academic results, how do you measure good pastoral care? You can't, you know, it's much harder. It's much less tenuous to actually measure it, but just as important. So I wouldn't want to, wouldn't rule out how important success is, but of course when we put it on a pedestal, it's an idol.
It's probably gone off. That success for one person may not be the same as success for somebody else. And that what we really need to do is encourage our youngsters to achieve to the best of their ability, whether that ability is at this level or at that level. And I think from that point of view, that's where I've just struggled with you saying that this one's well-educated and that one's wise, because they might both be well-educated, but one has the wisdom as well. I know it was. Yeah.
Oh, I'm going to have to think to you, we're not moving here, are we? How do you think it's in that here? It's more emotions.
To say love and affection, and they know exactly what the standards are, and some of them find it a challenge to meet what we would consider really basic standards of behaviour and understanding that those standards. That's a really big part of our job, because many of these students will not go on to achieve the success. One of the big positives about GCSEs when they were introduced was that you couldn't fail a GCSE because C wasn't a pass grade. And yet everyone knows that, you know, with local colleges, if you want to go to an advanced course, you've got to get grade C's at GCSE. And the students themselves, even though we talk about passing at GCSE being a grade G, the students themselves don't want to know if it's not a grade C or above.
I think if I wanted to go over at Weaver, which is obviously prior to it had a strong reputation for high academic achievement, still has. I was conscious that not everyone in the school felt a commitment to it, pupil-wise, that is. And as I looked at this and reflected on this, I felt that it was because success was fairly narrowly defined. And one of the things I set myself to in the first few years was to find somewhere in the life of the school that every child could be successful. Because I think not only does that feel better for them, but it raises their self-esteem. So it gives them hope that when they're sat in a maths lesson and they can't do the maths, that if they have another go at the question, they might actually get it right next time. And if you don't have that hope, which comes from high self-esteem, then you're struggling. And that's why we put a lot of effort into creating a lot of different opportunities for children to find success. So some of them, and for many of them, it is academic, and you know, and it is getting all A stars. But for others, it's about playing rugby on a Saturday morning and excelling in that and being good at that. It's about putting the books away in the library. It's about, you know, being the person in charge of the register. But finding some way that everyone can be successful, because that's where their self-esteem comes from. And it wasn't something that I think I got originally. I saw it in my role as a deputy head, when I saw a massive change in the lad that I was teaching, his ability to understand physics. I think my teaching was as mediocre as it always was, but a massive change between him taking a leading part in the school production prior to then and after that. And because he had this element of success and being seen and doing something that he was good at, almost miraculously, his ability to cope with physics just took off. And I think that sense of finding what people are good at, building, giving them that sense of success, builds their self-esteem to enable them also then to tackle the academic challenges that come along. But it's about finding somewhere that everyone can be successful.
Thank you, Annabel. Let's go to another question.
Sorry, wrong way around, okay.
I grew up in Kent, and where we still have grammar schools. So I went to a grammar school, I took the 11 plus, which was great because it was really easy to learn and everyone was studying well and the teachers were good. But I've got quite a few friends who failed their 11 plus and then they really felt sort of a failure and really took that on with them. I just wondered, I don't know, what you thought about exams and sort of even segregating people in different, you know, standards for different subjects and how you sort of cope with that and, yeah. I don't know.
Mike, yourself?
Well, I think you will struggle not to set some subjects like maths. Sound bites that you hear from politicians, particularly of a right-wing persuasion, suggest that modern comprehensive schools try to stifle competitiveness. And they talk about the death of competitive sport in schools. As far as I'm aware, you know, particularly at primary school, there's more competitive sport now than there's ever been. There is a role for mixed ability teaching in some parts of the curriculum, but in terms of the research on the impact of comprehensive schools compared to grammar schools, I think the evidence is slightly in favour that children on the whole will do better at comprehensive schools as they will at grammar schools. And actually, if you go to a comprehensive school and you are super bright, your route through that comprehensive school, because most subjects will be set, it's almost like being in a grammar school, and you'll have all the other advantages as well.
I went to a grammar school. I'm a benefit of grammar school education, but I'd never want my children to go there for lots of reasons. I think the division that it makes between those who pass and those who don't is horrendous. And of course the other story of Kent is a large number of schools in special measures with Ofsted because of the lack of attainment in the secondary model schools that go hand in hand with grammar schools. So I'm fully committed, I have to say, to comprehensive education. It's not a question for me. There is no question. I'm very clear where I stand and why I stand there. And I appreciate that won't sit well with everyone. We have setting at Weaverham, and I believe in ability groups, but I don't believe in just dividing society into two. And that's effectively what the impact of the 11 plus was.
Mike's come back and then
we have a number of friends who live in Trafford, and the excruciating pain they've been through in the past 2 or 3 years as their children have eventually passed the 11 plus to get into the school of their choice. It's just a horrendous setup, and they actually contemplated 2 or 3 years ago moving into West Cheshire so they could go to a proper comprehensive school and not have to put their children through the pain and the pressure of passing the 11 plus.
David?
there are good rural comprehensives and there are good city comprehensives. There are also shocking schools in some cities, and my sadness is that when you have this grammar school divide, you might have a very good grammar school. The Blue Coat School in Liverpool is a spectacular school, but it has 800 people or 800 kids going for 120 places, and the three schools around it are awful by comparison. Now, I say awful advisedly, that their results are really dreadful, and that talks about that paucity. And I really fear for, and I feel so sorry for the families, local families, who try to get their kids into the Blue Coat and fail to get in, and then they know that they're going to go to a different school, and in those particular areas, I'm only talking about two or three boroughs, they are going to have a poor educational experience unless we invest heavily in those schools. Selection is a very controversial topic. It's interesting that good schools, good comprehensive schools, will still have selection, but they have different streams of ability all the way through. We also allow selection at university. We don't think it's any problem at all to select our students at university. It's okay to select at 17 or 18, but not at 11. And I do think there's a difference there between a young adult and someone who's 11, and I do fear for people who are told you are a failure at 10 or 11. I think that is terrible. But also there's this whole huge debate about the difference between vocational qualifications, a vocational route, and a more academic route, and how society, and probably how we in this room, may value someone who goes down different routes. My father went to a technical college. He didn't have that route. He went down through a technical college, he became an apprentice, and had a thoroughly useful life, he would say. So I think it is quite a complex area. The difficulty is, of course, it's not universal across the country either. In Kent, you have this different opportunity. But if you can find a good school, I don't actually think it matters whether it's a grammar school or a comprehensive school, actually. But I wouldn't want to say that all schools are good, and sadly they're not, and we do need to address those.
Right, let's go for the next question. Oh, I think Paul just had it, and then we'll come up here in a minute. To Kevin.
I just wonder what, you know, as Christian heads, could you give some example of, if you like, some of the pinch points you really face with issues at school because you are Christians?
Dave, let's start with you this time.
I've been a head for 6 years. I've excluded two pupils. I agonised about both those decisions. You want to be compassionate. You want to consider the interests and the very difficult circumstances if you're going to take that step. But equally, I'm minded what discipline means and my responsibility to the other 799 boys, who the particular individual was being very cruel and wasn't learning from his lesson. So I've agonised about school exclusion. That would be one example.
It's the things that keep you awake at night are the exclusions, because there's that sense of failure for the child, and the implications of that is massive, potentially, for that individual child. I think the other issue is around staff and how you treat them and how you deal with the member of staff who isn't performing as well as they should do in the classroom. And as a Christian, where you sit on that and how you take that action. I don't think there are actually great ethical issues, but I wasn't greatly happy when the staff decided to set up a yoga sort of class one week, and it all got resolved, and they thought, well, if I wasn't happy with it, then it wasn't worth the effort, so it folded at that point. So there are occasions like that, but there's not many of those, I think, directly. I think it's more the day-to-day issues that you come into contact with.
Mike? I've relished a few heated discussions, with former members of my leadership team who felt that we should be completely secular in our approach. Once I hid behind the law of 51% of our assemblies having to be of a Christian nature, but certainly I was having to remind them of that. But most of the ethical issues, I think, are ethical issues. The fact that you're a Christian may make you think about them a little more, but they're to do with exclusions and to do with staff.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, another question?
I'd like to take David back to the what you said about your father. I work in a hospital, and I won't just pick our hospital. I'll say that all hospitals face this challenge, that a lot of the people that are keeping the hospitals going at the moment, day to day, I'm talking about tradespeople, are going to retire and disappear, and that is going to have quite a big impact on the hospital. And so, you know, if you go into our workshop, you'll find plumbers, fitters, a carpenter. Of course, we often forget, don't we, that was the trade of our Lord. So I think, and I'd just like to have your thoughts on sort of links with industry and things that actually are very important, but maybe don't have academic qualifications.
Mike, do you want to start on that one?
We have to produce a population that is self-sustaining. But I really think that it's not just down to schools. You know, I have to remind colleagues, now and again you find tearful colleagues, they feel they've failed with a young person, and I have to remind them that we've done all we can. We've referred to other agencies where we can. We've really tried with that child for 5 years, but we've had them for 6 hours a day for 200 days a year. Most of their time is spent outside of school time. And I think government also has responsibility in terms of providing a viable economy.
Comments from my future?
I think Kevin, the question that you're asking is, where do people like those that you've described fit into our education systems that are, because they're not academic qualifications, I think. And I think I would say that I think one of the things that the British education system has struggled with over the last 50 plus years is how you validate vocational qualifications and how you give values to those skills, both in terms of the craft skills that you've described, but also in terms of the technical skills. And I don't think we've got an easy answer for that. The Wolf Report has just been published, which, it's got something like 40 recommendations, but nowhere does it have a clear view as to how validity would be given to those sorts of qualifications and those sort of skills. I think the other challenge is identifying what are the skills of tomorrow accurately, because I think we see a lot of job labour market information which suggests that some of the things you've talked about aren't greatly needed, and yet in reality we all know from our experience there is a need for those very definite craft skills. So it is a challenge, and you know, one of the things that I get excited about is going around at this time of the year designing technology lessons and seeing the coursework pieces that pupils have produced, because the quality of them is absolutely amazing, and their investment of time and energy is way beyond what they give to, you know, what you could stipulate in homework for a GCSE subject, because they've become engrossed in it, they've enjoyed that creative experience, and they feel they've produced something which is of intrinsic value in itself, and they're proud of it. And I think, you know, seeing those opportunities, giving those opportunities, encourages pupils, I think, you know, if they're not academically driven, to look at other areas and hopefully come into some of these. But the training routes into those things you've described aren't exactly clear either. And I think that's one of the challenges that we face as a society, is making those clear.
I'd agree with virtually everything David said. One small, if I may, to add, that increasingly our boys and girls need to be IT literate, and their skills are way ahead of us. They're digital natives, and we're some way behind trying to catch up. So I am fairly optimistic about that. Design engineering, vital skills for our country. It's interesting, that's what made Britain Great Britain in the 19th and 20th century. Now that's what China and India are investing in. My sadness, I was reading an article in the Times recently, said we produced last year 7,000 forensic graduates, forensic science graduates. I think there are 90 places in the UK a year. And that's because they've been watching CSI on TV, so they need good careers advice. There's nothing wrong with forensic science as a career if you're determined that's what you want to do. But we haven't got the place for 7,000 of them. there are 90 home office jobs in the year. So it does come back to good advice, good careers advice, and making common sense judgment calls. That's where good schools working with parents and business make those decisions. If I may, finally, there's a bit of sneering going on about media studies in the press. Actually, media studies graduates, given how important media is, IT and all that, media studies graduates are some of the most employable graduates in the country.
We are going to finish at 9 o'clock, so we've got time for at least one more, possibly two if we're quick. But we're nearly at an end, so yes? Can't actually, I saw a hand, I didn't see, oh, there we go. Yes, marvellous. Thank you.
As a parent of children about to embark on a high school career, how can we encourage them to take their Christian faith seriously? We've talked about the pressures and the the points that are going to be brought to bear on them as they go to high school. How can we support them and work in tandem with Christians in the high school to encourage them?
I think the first role is the home and the church. I'm going to make a plug for St John's. One of the reasons we're at St John's is because of the youth work here. We took a view that because Van and Laura, my daughter, was going to have struggles in a secular or in a post-Christian world, they need a good youth work. And I think that peer pressure is vital. And one of the things I've been thrilled about, and Carl have been thrilled about, is the love and support of the youth workers, because that will prepare them to stand for the Lord in school. Yes, you can try and find a school which has got to see you, and I think that's important. But far more important is what we do at home, and in particular in youth groups, Christian youth groups, in church.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree with that. I think it comes from what goes on in the home and being confident about your faith and celebrating that. And it's important for us as a church, isn't it, to realise and to question ourselves as to what place we give young people within it, and what confidence they feel in coming to the services. And do they feel they're of value to them, and would they be of value to their friends? You know, it's important we ask those sort of questions. How teen relevant are some of the things that we do on a Sunday? Because if they've got that confidence, and that's where it starts, in the home and the church, then they'll be confident going into school. My fear is if they're wobbly on that, you know, they think church is a bit boring. You know, so I don't really want to go, I wouldn't want friends to go either. You know, you're into trouble. But I think having got that confidence from the family, from the church experience, I think if there is a CU, I'd identify with it and get them to go along to it. Because all children in whatever sort of school, and I've taught in a church school and it's been exactly the same, find it difficult being committed, keen Christians in any context, because most of their peers aren't. And if they can find some kindred spirits and like-minded fellow Christians in the CU, it's a big encouragement, if nothing else. And I think just being together, they encourage each other on, and encourage them to go down that route. The other thing is you need to talk and be open with them. And they will, as they go through the teen years, challenge the reality of your faith. And unless they can see that's for real, then they won't be keen to take it into the context of the school in which they're working. But you'll need to talk through all the issues that come home that may have started with the sort of reading books you've had at primary school, but believe you me, the issues get a lot more diverse and a lot more near the knuckle as they go into secondary education.
Mike?
Understand, I think, that the secular pressure from their peers is enormous, and encourage them gently, as we already do. It is interesting. I've been coming to St John's now for 11 years, and it is interesting that it's great to see so many teenagers here, but a number of youngsters, 10, 11, 12, 13, once they get old enough to be left at home, they'll play that card with their parents and they won't come to church, and they may come back to church and faith in years to come. And it's a very difficult time, and one thing is certain with teenagers, the one way to get them not to do what you want them to do is to tell them what to do. And it's just getting this balance right, and I think it's perhaps something that I've thought about. I've got an 11 and an 8 year old, and I won't say it's been one of the motivating factors in looking at a faith school option for Hartford, but certainly you do question your own faith, and you wonder where that's going. And I know I've got a feeling that with one of our children it'll be straightforward in terms of their faith over the next 5 or 6 years. With another one it may not be, and that's why we're looking for members of the congregation for a bit of support and advice over the next few years as well. But it's understanding the enormous pressures of peer group pressure, and we see this. I can guarantee that at some point tomorrow one of my pastoral staff will be dealing with cyberbullying that's happened over the weekend, and I think that David said that they're so technologically advanced compared to us, even though I know my way around my laptop and my computer, they're so technologically advanced that there's things that we just can't be aware of, and peer group pressure is enormous.
Thank you. The bell has chimed, but Mrs. Charlton. Yes? I can't really say no to you, can I?
Go on. Just heard from the staff about Christian kids going to high school. I just wondered if there's something else on here. If one or two of our teenagers are still at that
age. I'm sure they'll thank you for the opportunity.
You were teenagers once.
Feel free to speak up if you wish. But. Yeah, what are mums for? Yeah, where's the microphone gone? There we go.
Cheers. Yeah, I'd say that sort of as you go to high school, not because you're at high school, but because that's the age you are, you do start to challenge not just your parents' belief, but your own belief. I think that parents need to support their kids whether they choose to following Christianity or not, but I think they do need to support them into Christianity, but at the same time you can't force them to believe something, so it's sort of striking a balance between the two and allowing them to question things. Anything to Richard?
One thing I'd say as well, like, I think this is a lot where people who might say, oh, I've not got kids or I'm not involved with kids, can kind of feel they shirk the responsibility a bit, but actually if you're a teenager that's involved in a church, you're looking to people who've gone through what you're experiencing at the time to see then how you like what you're aspiring to. So people who think, actually, I'm not involved with kids, I don't really need to, actually, it's those people that certainly I looked to when I was struggling with stuff, and seeing that actually that's a good example to follow and something that you can then aspire to and something that encourages you.
Well, that was it. I can't really see through there. Are we done on the? That's great. I mean, pretty encouraging that last comment about it's our own family, but actually church family as well, isn't it? And I think to see the importance of that, supporting one another through. I was going to say, just as a final thing, just because of what's going on at Hartford, Mike, I wonder if you just wanted to tell us your hopes for the future with church school. That option, just in brief, just people might like to know a little bit about that, and then we really will come to an end.
Yeah, it's something Governors and myself have been working on now for the best part of a year, and there's so many driving forces behind it, and some of them are practical, some of them are spiritual, and it's difficult to, you know, I think you ask different Governors for their motivation, and they'll all have different motivations. We have been accused of a conspiracy theory on the governing body, of the governors that go to Hartford, St John's, of driving this through and driving this forward. So that's two of us out of 20, Mike.
Both of us, yeah.
And
right.
it's something that, you know, we would hope to become a voluntary aided Church of England school by January. There's a now formal process to go through. I have been utterly amazed. Firstly, we've had some interesting governors' meetings, and for those of you that are school governors, unfortunately, a lot of governors' meetings are necessarily tedious, and we've had some really reaffirming, argumentative, and quite exciting and controversial governors' meetings in the past few months. And even the governors that have been opposed are now reconciled with the fact that this is the way that the vast majority of governors have decided the school wants to go. And just the thought that we, you know, I've always done Christian assemblies over the past 6 years as head teacher, and never felt like apologising for it. And it's been great having our own carol service in St John's, because it allows our parents, many of whom probably haven't been since a nativity play or the odd wedding and funeral and christening, it's great that we can be an integral part of parish life and school life and church life, and that over time that will be an accepted part of what goes on at Hartford. We will be setting a very simple question in the next couple of weeks. We'll set up a working party, and the question will be, what do we want Hartford High School to be like in 5 years' time? And once we've got the underlying principles of a voluntary Church of England school, we'll then work back from there. And obviously we'll work with governors, but when the status is achieved, half of our governors plus one have to be foundation governors, therefore Christians. So quite clearly there will be a huge role for the parish church to play in the life of Hartford High School.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you. There's been some good questions. On your behalf, I want to thank my three brothers up here. It's been very, very stimulating indeed. So thank you. We value your wisdom and your fellowship very much indeed.
So then we disagreed with you.
That's okay. I can cope with that. If you're not being told off by a teacher, well, you know.
Or a
head teacher. Three head teachers. Gosh, if I wasn't going to get in trouble, I never was. And so, yes, it brought it all back, my school days. But there's huge issues, aren't there? We all need help. And this is one of the ways we help one another, as we think through some of these real issues. They are real issues, aren't they, for us? And we need to help one another thinking through them. Gosh, none of us has arrived on any of this stuff. So thank you again, and thank you so many for staying for this evening. Let's just pray as we finish. Father God, it's been a long evening, but we do just want to pray that you might watch over and bless our young people and our own family here at St John's, Lord, in different schools, different stages, and pray that you might draw them to yourself and might enable them to stand up for you in their school or college, and Lord, to know your faithfulness to them. We pray for those in our church family who are teachers or involved in schools as governors, as parents, and in many different roles. And Lord, pray too that you might give each of us that commitment to pray and to work to be a godly influence in whatever way we can in those schools with which we're connected. Lord, we do pray for Weaverham High School, for Merchant Taylors, and for Hartford High, that have each been represented here this evening in their head teachers. We pray that you would prosper each of them, and we thank you that these schools are each headed by keen Christians. Lord, we do pray particularly for the future at Hartford, and as we hope we're now heading towards becoming a church school, Lord, we ask that that might go ahead straightforwardly, and that it might both keep on that side everyone who's currently involved in that school, as well as really making a difference in the long term with more explicit influence for good from the gospel and the links with the church. So Lord, please watch over us this night. Teach us above all wisdom, for we ask that you lead us in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.
Good, thank you all.